Hi guys, this is Craig Blundell on the Global Drum Network. Remember, practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes better.
Drum Network, bringing drummers together from all around the world. Yes, that's right. Hello and welcome to episode 8. I'm your host, Bob Spry, and this time we're back at the annual Freddie G Drum Academy, where we finally caught up with Craig Blundell and also had a chat with Woody from Brit Award-winning band Bastille. We'll round off today's show with a couple of the participants from the course who will give you a flavour of what it's like to immerse yourself in a full week of tuition from some of the world's best drummers and teachers. And listen out at the end for your chance to submit a question for Pink Floyd's Nick Mason. In the meantime, here's Craig Blundell. So we're backstage at the Freddie G Drum Academy. It's a beautiful evening. It's halfway through the course and barbecue's on. There's a fantastic steel band playing outside, but I've managed to drag away somebody who we've been trying to pin down for about a year now, but bless him, he's made some time for us. So pin back your luggles, ladies and gentlemen. International clinician and teacher, worldwide ambassador for Roland and Premier, composer and producer, otherwise known as Dr. Octopus. Ladies and gentlemen, Craig Blundell. Beautiful.
Thank you, Bob. Hello, everybody. It's lovely to be here. Finally, we managed to get something together. Bob tried to pin me down last year at this event, and you're surrounded by 60 students who want answers to every single question. That 8 hours isn't enough. So I'm delighted that I can share what bit of knowledge I have for you, Bob.
I'm not sure we got enough tape on this machine to capture half of that. So last year I saw at first hand how your work ethic works. I was able to speak with some of the other tutors here, but you were putting in the extra hours just carrying on teaching after the sessions had gone. And when people have asked, and I'm sorry if this is going to sound like I'm blowing smoke, I'll apologise.
No, of course, I'll apologise
in advance. But when people have asked, when students have asked anybody else, who's a really good clinician to go and see? I'll always say, well, do you want to be blown away with technique and walk away afterwards feeling, do you know what, that bloke practices 8 hours a day. I'm never going to be as good as him. I might as well stop. Or do you want to be blown away with great technique by somebody who's going to inspire you to go home and pick your sticks up and play straight away? Because if you want to be inspired, go see Craig Blundell. No, it's true. It's true. That's and that was borne out when I came last year. So
that's very kind.
I've written down infectious energy because that's how you always come across. And I know you're a real workaholic, which is why it's been so hard to pin you down.
Absolutely.
So could you tell our listeners, you've actually made quite an unusual start to your drumming career, as I recall.
Royal Marines. Yeah, I was born. I'm getting older now. I passed my 40th, which was it was a bit of a chore actually. If I'm not going to lie to you,
that was
it's that thing you get a little bit older and stuff, and realise that I've got so many ambitions to fulfil. I kind of started playing when I was really early on, sort of three. Really amazing drummer called Ian McGeer, the Swinging Blue Jeans, 60s okay. band fame, yeah. was a very close friend of the family and used to give sticks and cymbals. Mum was
working hard to keep the house there. My dad was a joiner, so he didn't bring a lot of money in. So pretty much most of my kind of early years was based on a broken cymbal, a broken old Zildjian cymbal, and some battered old sticks, Premier sticks, actually. And I got a fascination with just hands, with absolute hands. And a friend of mine, I used to drum on the tables at school, and a friend of mine was like, you should come to the local Sea Cadets. They're really good. They got a core of drums. And I was like, well, what's a core of drums, you know? So I went along and realised that I loved playing in a section. And then because it was Sea Cadets, it was Navy. Because it was Navy, they were connected to the Royal Marines Cadets, transferred to the Marines Cadets. And they were like, check out the Royal Marines Band. And I was like, I've seen these guys, and they're just like robotically amazing. So I was kind of fascinated from about the age of about 11 with these guys, seeing them on television and the Edinburgh tattoo. And then the next thing I find myself as a 16-year-old boy, because you are a boy at that age, you know, and you've no Xbox generation, that's oldie. It was like everything was analog, wasn't it? So I trotted down to Deal and did my audition. The week
that was a hell of a step for a 16er.
Do you know what? It was interesting, you know, because it was all over the country, and I had my ticket and I had my borrowed suit, because I'd never owned a suit before. And down we go to these amazing drummers who auditioned me, and I realised then I was fairly out of my depth, but they saw something. So I joined up, and then some 4 years later, I was one of the principal drummers in the Corps of Drums Royal Marines, and I was deeply proud of that. And I used to write a lot for them. So when all the guys are, I had a few drinks than when I shouldn't have, when I was at a certain age and stuff with the guys, and I realised it was quite a drinking culture when you finish off work, and I decided to go the other way and start writing. So. When we used to knock off at like 1 o'clock, this is after training, I was down based at the Royal Yacht Britannia Band in Portsmouth. I used to sit and write, and I used to hear things in my head during the day, rhythms, write them down, right now. I was an obsessive writer. And then I find my stuff commissioned to be playing at the Albert Hall, Edinburgh Tattoo, FA Whoa. Cup final and stuff like that. And as a kid, I was pre-20, that was a real honour. And I left, I got bored, but I wanted new challenges. And but I still write for the Marines. I still teach going back to the Marines. They're deeply close to my heart. And I performed with them last year at the Festival of Remembrance live on BBC One, which was an honour to go back to the Royal Albert Hall and play drums, but with the Corps of Drums and with the whole band who were my friends 20 years ago, which is just amazing.
So you were playing kit?
I was playing kit, and I wrote this crazy, odd-time, freaky snare drum electronica piece, and they all performed in front of me, and I was in bits afterwards. I was just like, I was so proud, you know. It's very cool. Yeah, absolutely. It's from like proper heart stuff. My mum was in tears, my sister's in tears, all my friends were like, I'm so proud of you, you know. And it's another tick in the box for me to go back, because you know, I'm really deeply respectful of my roots and where I've come from, and no matter what I am now, wherever you see yourself in the pecking order, feet are on the floor, but I always talk about my roots. I'm very proud of my roots and the people who've helped me, because, you know, on the way up, they've been fantastic to me. On the way down, I might need them again, and
absolutely,
they'll always be my friends. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's sound advice too. It's been sound advice evening tonight, boys and girls. So, what made you leave the Royal Marines?
I got quite complacent, if I'm being honest. I got an offer came in from eight gentlemen that were the old Royal Marines Royal Yacht Britannia dance band, and they had quite a big function band at the time called Alpha Connection, and they've been around for quite a few years, and on the South Coast they're really well known, and they used to do all the kind of the London Park Lane hotels, and money was good, and blah. So I went.
They run an agency too, didn't they?
They're really well known, and they're still around, and so I thought I'll go on for an audition. I'll go and see what they have to say. And I love what they'd say. And there was an element of freedom, which I really liked. I can go and play Mustang Sally and things like that. It's like, wow, I'm dreaming of doing that, you know? It's like, I was 20 years of age, and I'm thinking, I want to play kit, because I was a snare drummer in the Marines. I wasn't a kit drummer. I failed my kit audition, ironically. bizarre. And so I really wanted to play kit, and I met these guys. I love what they'd say. They could tell they were Marines, ex-Marines, but they had a bit of fun about them. There's a bit of like kind of loose cannonness about the whole thing. So I joined them. I stayed with them for 10 years, and they taught me my trade, because we were playing swing and shuffles and stuff that I'd never played before, and I really sucked at it. I really sucked, and it really kicked me up the bum to say, right, I need to dig deeper, because technically
I was in Pro Land then. I was playing with the big boys, and they did a few BBC thing, Generation Game, and things like that.
I was going to say, this is going to make me sound anoraki, but I can remember seeing them on there. And a mate of mine was actually with a band that was managed by Alpha Connection.
No way. Yeah, it's... I had to dig deep. I really, really had to dig deep. And there's another chapter of my life. It was a chunk, actually. So the Marines chunk, and I did the Alpha Connection chunk for 10 years. And then the record deal thing came, and really took me here, because I wanted a new challenge, and these guys in London wanted me to play drums for them. It was like, oh my God, playing original stuff. I can be even more creative, but that was the next chapter. Didn't end well. as the most record companies don't, you know. Yeah, the Alpha Connection thing was great because it really kicked me up the bum to learn. I hate the word session, I really do, because I think it's a completely overused phrase. It's massively diluted because you're playing two bands in a pub or a social club. It doesn't make you a session drummer. The session drummers were stacked records and people like that in Black Classic Motown that spent their days in studio. You're just a freelance drummer that plays in a few projects. You're not a session joiner if you build two houses, you know. You do other products, you know. It's diluted. So I wanted a new chapter in my life, and it's just been chunks and chunks and chunks of differentness completely.
Yeah. So what happened next then? So the signed original band fell through.
Now this was weird. It gets even more bonkers. So I found this four-piece band called Reflector, who great. We charted.
With a K?
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, and we charted and we did ever so well. And the guys wrote great pop rock songs, which was fantastic. And by some strange twist of fate, by the singer who knew somebody in Henley, we got signed to Sarah Ferguson. She had a record label. She decided to have a go at a record label. And as gullible 20-whatever-year-olds... Yeah, absolutely.
Was it a tax loss thing?
Quite possibly. We signed to them. Never saw her. And then realised 2 or 3 months in that this wasn't right. This was crazy. We couldn't get pickups, people's phone. And of course, at the time... There's no retirement, so I had no income and a family at the time. So it was like, young family, need to pay stuff, and there's nothing coming in because I'd given up the security. So it was like, oh, really need to think about it. So we sacked her, and then it made front page news. And we found ourselves on The Big Breakfast. We were on all the TV shows because we'd sacked the Duchess at the time. And we got nothing off the back of it, you know. All these two-bit record companies came in, so we'll give you a retainer of 50p and whatever it may be, you know.
Bugger.
So I was like, oh, man, seriously. So for me then, it was like, right, I've got to face the reality, and it's nothing to be ashamed of getting a grown-up normal job. So that's exactly what I did. Yeah. I started driving, delivering fruit and veg, doing whatever I could to pay the bills. And I found myself on an agency in Surrey, just driving cars, and they had a contract with Porsche. So it's fantastic. So I went one day from delivering fruit and veg to delivering 9/11 cars. It's great. And I got on really well with the guys there, and they offered me a job like within a couple of months. So I worked there for quite a long time. Nothing I don't know about those things now.
Yes.
Don't own one, but there's nothing I don't know about them.
You know exactly how to drive them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
What more do you need to know? People who own them don't know that.
Absolutely.
What happened next after that? Because you were combining... Making a living at a proper job.
Absolutely.
Whilst establishing yourself on the drumming scene.
Absolutely trying to. It was quite a push-pull, and I realised I still had quite a lot to learn. So I was working at Porsche. That didn't quite work out in the end. I wanted to do other things. I'm a massive golfer. I'm a real big golfer. It's still a massive passion of mine. So I decided I really wanted to work at a golf club. So I joined the golf club. I joined the golf club and got on really well with the people. This is some 4 or 5 years later. Nothing had happened. Still doing a few pub gigs and, you know, playing little shuffle gigs for 20, 30 quid, which wasn't about the money. It was just I wanted to play. I really wanted to play. So I found myself working at a golf club around the mid-90s. And one day, my kit, I had a massive big AOC kit, double bass drum, the whole kind of 80s prog, 90s prog thing.
Yes.
I found myself playing in...
Wood hoops?
Yeah. Absolutely, wood hips top everywhere, top and bottom. It was a lovely kit.
Yeah.
And I found myself playing just in the greenkeeper shed after work. So I'd do the whole day dealing with snotty customers, go and play some golf, and then unlock the greenkeeper shed, go and play some golf. Go and play some drums, should I say. So, and then one day, there was a knock on the door at the greenkeeper shed, and there was this lovely American, Canadian guy called Dale, and he says, I've heard your drums, sound great, would you come do a session for us tomorrow? Yeah, I'd love to. Who? Just, the drummer hasn't turned up, just bring a kit, come in to come down. I was like, okay. So there I was, in deepest, darkest Sussex. I turned up to these gates, and lo and behold, Mike Rutherford opened the door from Genesis. I'm a massive prog head. And we were recording an album for Celine Dion. And I'd never recorded before.
I'm blown.
I'd never, ever recorded before. And for those that, I don't know if you know what I do or not, but for those that you know, me and Celine Dion, with the way I play and the stuff that she does, not going to get along. And it was a really difficult session because I was trying to impress. I was still a young lad, trying to impress and overplaying. And Mike saying stop through this big glass window at Fisher Lane Farm Studios. Me going a little bit simpler, saying stop. Me going a little bit simpler. And it was just literally, the take was dumped, cat, dumped. Cat, ding, don't, cat. That for me is like, it's hell for me. You know? And it's not the way I play and that way my living. Ironically doing the BBC stuff, but that's a long story. But it was a real insight to playing for the song. I'd never ever played for the song in 20 right. years. I'd just played for myself and had some fun and realised that...
Even in the Alpha Connection.
Absolutely. If I play in Celebration or Cool and the Gang, a lot of stuff... I'd thrown a few chops just to keep it interesting, you know, and realise, been a bloody idiot, really, you know? There's no integrity there whatsoever, you know? So, thank God I play proc now. That's all I'll say, realistically. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm ridiculous. Ridiculous. But it was great, and I was saying on Freddie G to the kids this week, who were just like... Like, if you turn the Roland kits off, they sound like typewriters because they're just rinsing around it. They're just like... I said, that's never going to get you the work, guys. What's going to get you the work is sitting on a click and playing. Never underestimate the value of a click. And they've all learned that this week. Even some of the seasoned pros about click track. You know, it's been incredible.
Intriguing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the first... Were you endorsing Mapex the first time we'd have seen you...
Properly, I guess. Coming out as a vague small box in Rhythm Magazine or something small where nobody knew the hell I was. By hook or by crook, I bought myself a Mapex kit, Mapex Mars or something a while ago. And I was teaching at Horndean College down in Hampshire. And I used to cart this kit everywhere and it was fantastic, blah, blah, blah. And then I went to some drum festival in early 2000s and Mapex were there. And I spoke to them, it's Korg, obviously, the distributor. I spoke to them, I said, I've got one of your kits, I love it, it's fantastic, you know. Here's my card, it was a horrible one of those petrol station cards that you got like £5 for his 15 and there's red for. Here's my card, you know, I'd love to do something with Mapex, you know, I play in front of a lot of kids and you know, they all need drums. Nothing whatsoever. Saw them at another show and they're like, we've been hearing things about you. It's like, really? Because what I did, I started putting on clinics because with my feet firmly on the floor, I was a bit mature and I'd learnt by my mistakes, a bit more mature and I'd learnt by a few more mistakes and I'd realised that I've got a message and I'm passionate and I think there's something that somebody can learn off what I do, you know? And so I started doing clinics in my local pub in Godalming in Surrey. And so my landlord was brilliant and this was after work, so I started inviting all the ACM, because all the ACM guys were near Guildford at the time, didn't know who the hell I was. And then we started selling out to the point that these manufacturers would come and see me play. And I was like, wow. And then they offered me a deal. And you know, for the podcast listeners that are listening now, deals don't come easy. Everyone says they got a deal, blah, blah, blah. And it's brilliant, but the real true big deals don't happen that often. Mm-hmm. And they offered me a free kit, and free doesn't happen nowadays.
Absolutely,
you know, it really doesn't. And they offered me a free kit, and I was gracious, open arms, because I was already playing the kit. And and Mapex were absolutely fantastic. And then they started putting on some stuff, and I found myself on the bill on Drumfest 2004. I wasn't even a pro. I was still working at the golf club or Porsche, wherever it was, one of the two, and I had to throw a sickie. to go up to the rehearsals on the Friday or whatever it was and do the gig or the Saturday and I was on the bill with Mark Richardson, Liberty DeVito, Jason Bold, some great iconic players of their generation and time and their genre, and I was just the guy that was working fixing cars, playing drums in front of an audience of 500, didn't know who the hell I bloody was, you know, and that really kind of broke me. A little bit. I won't say, like, oh, look at me, I'm rich and famous, blah, blah, blah. But it kind of broke me into, like, who's this guy? So there's an element of intrigue. And then it started to snowball a bit and then stopped. And then snowballed again. And I didn't have a gig. I was doing pub gigs, which is great. But I didn't really have a gig to warrant the exposure of doing these massive drum festivals and clinics. And Mapex then put me out with Russell Gilbrook. And they put me out with Nick DiVigilio and Greg Bissonette in 2000 and whatever. And I was like... God, you know, these are my heroes. These are monster players. And I'm throwing sickies to go and do the job, you know? It's ridiculous. But what I did do, I practiced my bum off. I never, ever stopped practicing. And to the point of now, even now, I'm still uber anal about my approach to my art and my instrument. It's a bit more further on now. It's a bit more serious, obviously. But I, even then, back in the day, sort of 10, 15 years ago, I always wanted to do it for a living. So I realised you only get out what you put in. Yeah. So I put a lot of time in. So I'd finish work at 5. I'd be up at 6 to go to work, finish work at 5. Then I'd do 3 or 4 hours practice. Because that's my dream. That was my goal, just to literally turn my passion, or turn my hobby into paying the bills and have it as, I hate the word job, because it sounds like a chore, but you know, to have my passion pay the bills and do it day in, day out and help people, that was my goal.
Yeah.
You know, and by the grace of God, I find myself here now, you know, so it's gone a long way.
And if you could encapsulate in a nutshell your philosophy on practice, because here you are, an established and much sought after teacher. Mm. In a nutshell, what's your philosophy on practice?
My philosophy on practice, as always, is you get out what you put in. My also practice is the maths and PE approach, i.e. when I used to go to school, I used to dread double maths in the morning. I used to dread double maths and then look forward to double PE in the afternoon because I know the afternoon would be fantastic. If it was reversed, if I was doing double PE, which I loved, the sport, and I had double maths in the afternoon, I would dread it. So what I tend to do now with my practice routine, and I've gone through the gazillion hours a day of practice now, and I've learned a lot of stuff, like core fundamental stuff. Everything else is just icing now. And I'm still learning new concepts and stuff as I go. But I practice an hour a day, and I do 30 minutes of stuff. It's purely simple, actually. I do 30 minutes of things I can't do. Yeah. I'm working on, I do 30 minutes of things I can do. So that'd be iPod practice and just sit, play to songs, or Pendragon or Frost or whatever now. On the hard part, I put the time in. And it might be learning the charts,
right,
with stuff that is like slow. It's the double mass, it's the working thing, it's the brain space stuff.
Yes.
And then you finish and you do all the fun stuff, have a bit more of a smile on your face. And then when I finish my practice for the day, I close the studio door with a smile on my face instead of being quite frustrated by not getting there. And seven days a week, 7 hours, after 7 hours of really tough practice, by the Saturday, Sunday, that really tough practice starts to go into the good column,
yes,
into the fun column, and then translate into the hands and the feet. And that's all I do, realistically, with lots of weird concepts that I'm still working on for the book and stuff. So, yeah.
Okay, but again, that's interesting advice, because there are, let's face it, you know, millions of approaches,
absolutely,
to practice. Not everything works for everybody.
Yeah, totally.
But I think you're absolutely right. You know, that's something I always try to get across to students, is practice first the stuff that you're struggling with.
Yes, absolutely.
Work through that with the carrot, if you like, of playing the fun stuff later in your session.
Absolutely, totally. And one thing I've got this week, Bob, to be fair, is I've got 60 guys on this course. Most of them are looking for a practice routine. Because as humans, and I'm sure the guys listening will probably hopefully agree, you tend to sit on our kit and play what makes us feel happy. We'll play our favourite groove. We'll play our blah, 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 blah. It's getting in that mindset of, right, sit. I'm here to do my job. I'm here to work. I'll do the graph now. I'll get the benefit.
Yes.
And that's it. It's graft and get out. Simple as that, really.
Yeah. And so for fun now, you're playing with... you've been playing with Frost.
Yeah.
And... now Pendragon.
Pendragon, yeah, yeah.
Extremely uber prog stuff.
Yeah, but they're kind of like my two favourite gigs now, you know, because I don't do pop stuff. It's not my bag. I'll say that to the pop guys, and taking, as I say in every interview I do, taking nothing away. What they do is wonderful. Two things: I would get bored. I would get fired. I got offered quite a big gig this year, and I made no bones about it. Arena gig for 9 months, fantastic. But it's just not me, and I'm a massive man of integrity. The Frost gig, because they have quite an underground following, is a wonderful gig, and they're dear friends of mine, and they are just, in their right, ridiculously world-class players. I've been a fan of Pendragon for probably 15 years, and they are an absolute monster, iconic UK prog rock band. So there I was mowing my lawn, as everything is quite bizarre with everything I've done. I was mowing my lawn about 2 months ago, and... an email came through at info@pendragon, and I thought it was a spam because I'm on a mailing list, I wonder who it was. And it was Nick Barrett, the guitarist, saying, I've been trying to get a hold of you, I've got your number, can you give me a call? And I was like, Nick Barrett, what? So I rang him up saying, we've just parted companies with our drummer, I'm not interested in politics, blah, blah, blah. We would love you to do this album. the new Pendragon album, really. When? Well, we're in studio now. When can you get down? I was like, oh, blow my neck. So they give me, they said, look, we'll give you a week. I said, no, give me 2 days. I'll learn the stuff because I'm kind of anal about my approach. So I learned the stuff in 2 days. And they said, how long do you want to record the album? Once I listened to it, I charted it and did myself some cheat sheets and stuff. They allowed a week and a half bit for drums. I said, look, we'll do it in 2 days. We'll do it. And we did it in 2 days. And I have all the things I've done. I have all the BBC drums that everyone listens to every morning on your radio and stuff. Yeah. It's one of the proudest things I've ever played on it. I am so happy with what happened.
Yes.
So the album comes out in October. And then we've got a big European tour, huge European tour.
Fantastic.
Which I'm really looking forward to. You know,
yeah.
They're lovely, lovely men. Lovely guys that I know I'm going to have a lot of fun with on tour bus because I've kind of known them through bizarre consequences, through Frost, because the prog fraternity knows everybody.
Yeah.
And they've got nothing but great reputations, all the three guys. And we're a bit older, a bit wiser, and we're going to drink some nice wine and play some lovely music.
Nice.
And they've got a lovely following all over Europe. And
what better way to spend 9 months?
Wonderful.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And that's hot on the heels of having been out to China recently for Roland, certainly. Was that with
Premier?
No,
it was Premier. It was actually Premier. Okay. It was wonderful. I mean, part of my role is, you know, Steve White's recently, my big brother, has just joined Premier again, which I'm deeply thrilled about. So he's doing the education stuff for the UK, and there's no better person in the UK, for my mind, that can do that. I'm doing the international clinician, so I'm the international guy. Hardly the face of, but I'm going to turn up and try and educate some people.
You say that, but on your Twitter feed, I saw a fantastic picture of you with out in the street somewhere in China.
Yeah.
With a larger than life picture of yourself in the background.
It's, do you know what? It's really interesting, Bob. I was saying to the guys in the studio, I only came back this week from China, from the 2 week clinic tour of China, second time. And I got absolutely mobbed, which I'm not a massive fan of. I'm just a little shy guy that has to go back and have a cup of tea at home. They don't know the Western culture. They don't know Western drummers. There's no, obviously, social media out there. They are absolutely drilled to perfection as instrumentalists. And there's millions and millions and millions of drummers. Average clinic attendance at my clinic was over 1,000. So it's festival type. And then you do a 2-hour signing afterwards and photographs. And the Chinese will do everything they possibly can to get their photograph. It was amazing. There's a lot to be... They've only had the drum kits in sort of 1986, 1987, which is kind of hard to believe. So they don't know. They don't know the Dave Weckles and people like that. And I went out to dinner with a guy who wrote China's first drum book. And it was a really insightful experience. And they don't really have knowledge. They're deeply respectful of Westerns. Westerners as drummers, but they don't have the knowledge because they don't have the internet access to them.
I
watched all these percussion guys and playing these monster charts with no emotion, no feelings, nothing, just straight faced. And then I do my thing and they just go absolutely nuts. I felt like I put a little bit of a stamp, a little bit of a mark out there regarding education. And I've got quite a few trips there next year, which I'm really, really looking forward to. It's a wonderful market with some unbelievably talented children that could absolutely fly.
If you need a drum tech.
Oh, absolutely.
So, thank you very much for your time up to this point.
Yes.
Can I just whiz a couple more questions
at
you? Of course. Who would you say your best teacher is in every sense? So, you know, not necessarily drumming, but in life in general.
I'm going to struggle not to get emotional here, but it would have been my late father.
Ah.
He drilled me amazing. Probably my mum, she's ace. She's the voice of reason. I have a dear friend. I have some dear friends that have guided me over the past recent times, through all the dark times and the good times, that I will turn to in regard of advice. Steve White is a huge, huge, huge big brother of mine, and he's been there for me for all sorts of things in personal life and all sorts of things in music life. And I'm deeply indebted to what he's brought to me as a person and as a player, which I think is really, really cool. He doesn't know it, but he's a massive mentor of mine for the way he runs his life and the way he runs his business. And but he does know it. I've told him after a few wines. I've told him a few times and stuff. But I think it's important to have somebody outside looking in that can help you, and he's been great. I've got some dear friends, and it's very interesting. I don't want to get too deep and non-drummy here, but when you're in a darker place, you realise who your friends are. And when you're going through some as in there's no gigs, there's no money, I'm in trouble here, you realise who your friends are. And I've still got them around, which I'm... Thank you for that. Cool, blimey. Absolutely.
That's really sweet. Thank you for that. Most profound piece of advice you've ever received?
You can't keep true talent down. And that is so true, you know. And you can be the best player on the planet. You can be the best player in your street. You can be the best player in your house. And if you're not getting recognition, you know, it can be quite a daunting place. And you can think, why aren't I getting the gigs? I'm seeing this pop drummer on television. I'm not stereotyping pop. I'm seeing this rock drummer on television. I'm better than him. You just not had your break yet. Simple as that. And you will get your break. But for every break, there's 20, 30, 40, 50 knocks. It will kick you back, you know. If you're the bigger man or the bigger girl, you can get up, dust yourself down. If you are talented, there is a market. There is a job there for you. Just don't give up, you know. And I got my break, and I mean break by paying a few bills and with my feet on the floor, some people knowing what I do for a living and being inspired by what I do. I got it fair late on in life, as everyone says, but I worked for 20 years of ups and downs and kicks and knocks wherever to get it. And you know, you can see to a lot of the drummers that you see nowadays, and Robin Guy was talking about last night, exactly the same, you know. And you can't keep good talent down. And dust yourself off, get up and keep going. If it's your passion, you'll get there in the end.
That's it. And that's something I always ask. Our watchword on the Global Drum Network is whatever you play, play it with passion.
Absolutely.
So what makes you most passionate these days about music, about drumming? Who or what inspires you now?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a great question. What inspires me? I hate throwing product down people's faces. You know, all of you guys at home listening to this will all play your own brands, and that's absolutely fantastic. There's no bad any brand anymore. Which is great, you know, testament to the people that have made your drums and cymbals and electronics. You know, with Roland, my connections with Roland, I'm in the R&D team and I design a lot of sounds for the guys. And, you know, I see millions of hits of people on YouTube playing their stuff on their Roland videos and stuff. And they're my sounds, which is kind of cool. It's kind of like, wow, I did that in a pair of pants in my garage when I was struggling, you know. So that's really, really smart. I love seeing guys. I mean, I've got a nice little database of private students that come to me when I'm in the country, because it's not so often anymore. I love going to watch them play, and I love going to watch them play in the stuff that we've learned, and they're putting their own slant on it now. That makes me like the proud dad. But I love seeing kids play, and you know, with the greatest respect, the next generation. I love seeing kids play with the right attitude. I love seeing kids play with hunger. We live in an Xbox generation now, where it's quite easy to just put the sticks down. As I found with quite a lot of students, they've got so many options what to do to log on to Xbox, to log on to whatever, you know. There's that passion and hunger. And it's not as much as I saw when I was younger with the kids, and if I'm being really honest now. But the ones that are true to their values, that are really, really want this, and they're 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, that want it and they're eager to soak up knowledge, that inspires me. I posted a picture on my Facebook feed of this 5-year-old girl that I met in China that played a page of stick control, absolutely note perfect. And I was in bits. I was in absolute, as a parent myself, I was in bits anyway. But watching these kids just play this stuff that have worked their absolute pants off for however long they've been playing, the hunger to succeed and the hunger to progress and be the best, that inspires me so much.
That, I tell you what, that's a beautiful place to leave it. But
okay, that's cool.
I've got to ask you your favourite or most embarrassing or hilarious gig you've ever done.
Oh my god, I've got so many. Well, I went on tour with Little and Large, which sucked. So we did bingo clubs, and we got pretty much thrown. You know those dubber pens you get, the pens that do all the bingo numbers. I was rained on with hailstones with those pens, and we did gala bingo club in Paisley because Little and Large was so bad at the time. I opened the Trafford Centre with Rene, or from Rene and Renata, and he hated me. I opened Gala Centre, Cardiff or Swindon, with Shirley Bassey, and I was so naive at the time, I thought it was Shirley Bassey, but it was a lookalike that won Stars in the Rise, which I'd basically been posting all these pictures to my mum and stuff, and so I'm like, this is Shirley Bassey, and she's like, that's not Shirley Bassey. I don't think it was Shirley Bassey, it wasn't, it was a lookalike. I did Joe Pasquale, I did the Generation Game. I have so many, but one of my crowning thoughts was I was with the Royal Marines in 1993, St. David's Hall, Cardiff, and we came on, and it's the first time I passed, one of the first times I passed out. Privilege, we marched on stage, we did all the drumming, lifting sticks to the nose thing, did all that uber drum corps stuff, and then I was to turn right, lead the core drums off stage. There was two doors, take the left door, that would take us backstage. We'd then have an hour and a half off till we come on, place Evening Sunset, finish the concert, everyone's happy. I marched the core drums off, I took the door, I opened up. We spent an hour and a half in a broom cupboard and waited there for the rest of the show. And my name, the swear words I can't begin to tell you because we couldn't get out because it was visible on stage. So, you know, but the great thing is, guys, is that you've got to have all these character building, stupid knocks along the way that, you know, I'm newly crowned 41 years of age now and very blessed to be doing this for a living. I wouldn't be where I am now. And I mean by where I am now by paying my bills through my passion if it wasn't for the ups and the downs, mainly the downs, because it's just unbelievably character building stuff. From doing that, the big arena gigs to the rubbish little dog and duck gig that you could ever imagine and getting thrown off stage and people falling into your kit. Yes. It just makes you appreciate that, you know, there's a gig there for everybody. Absolutely.
There is. Craig, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure.
That's brilliant.
Thank
you very
much.
Hope you enjoyed that, listeners.
Thank you, guys. And I've got my Facebook, my Twitter, and I've got my little columns in Rhythm Magazine. You can see where I am, what I'm doing around the world, and hopefully I'll get to see you live soon.
And next up, after a quick thirst quencher on a warm summer's evening, here's Chris Woody Wood.
So here we are, boys and girls. A year goes by so quickly when you're having fun and when you're working hard. And we're back here at the Freddie G Drum Academy, once again at the Sparsholt College near Winchester. And lo and behold, lull before the storm, before a band kicks off on barbecue night halfway through the week. We've just been treated to a really nice clinic from Bastille's Woody, who's here for a quick chat now.
Hi.
Good evening, Woody. How are you doing?
I'm very well, sir. How are you?
Very well. Sun shining. It's blisteringly hot, isn't it?
Grand.
And you managed to slot this in just before embarking on a quick trip to Italy.
Yeah, Italy, America, Lithuania, you know, the big three.
Yes.
Doing all that. And it's been, it's just the stars seem to have aligned slightly, so it's good.
Fantastic. And it's been a heck of a year for you.
It's been a heck of an 18 months even.
Yeah.
It's just been non-stop basically. Once since the album came out, our manager did tell us that when it happens, your feet aren't going to touch the ground. It's like, yeah, whatever.
Yes.
And turns out she was right. So we've been home, I think, worked out about less than 70 days in the last 18 months. But that's a very good headache to have.
It is, yeah. It's the kind of headache that most of us would give our eye teeth to have.
Mm-hmm.
But
fantastic. Very, very glad to have it, yeah.
Yeah, you've got to ride the roller coaster when the thing kicks off,
haven't you? Exactly.
So Brit nominations and massive public adulation, lots of record sales as a result of a lot of hard work.
Yeah, it's been surreal really. We all got background people there. Hi. I've been playing with Dan for over 5 years now, and I think the kind of perception amongst a lot of people is that, it just kind of happened overnight, it came out of nowhere. But, we've been working away and practicing and touring and, staying on friends of friends' floors, borrowing cars to get to gigs, all that sort of thing. So, it's been a long old slog, but it's been a fun one. But I think you definitely get found out if you don't really want to do this job.
Yes.
At that stage. When,
yes,
you
don't
kind of
put the graft in. Like you say, pay your dues.
This is it. And we've been, it's a combination of a little bit of luck and timing, but also like an awful lot of hard work and diligence, I guess. It's been good though. But yeah, long may it continue, hopefully. But hopefully I'm not working at KFC next year. see how it pans out.
It could be worse. So, how long you got playing? How long have you been playing? Sorry, got you started? What was your first inspiration?
So, my dad is a guitarist and singer. So, ever since I was very little, I was always kind of around bands and kind of seeing him play at gigs, that sort of thing. And I guess I was kind of drawn towards the drums a little bit. Rather naively, I actually thought that if I played drums, I wouldn't have to learn to read music. But yeah, that soon became quite clear that was not the case. But See, I started playing when I was about 11, so like last term of primary school.
Yeah.
And then kind of progressed through like grades up to like grade 6 through secondary school at a very, very good teacher in Plymouth called Colin Bacon. And then prior to going to music college, I kind of decided in the last year of A-levels that I was going to pursue music. So my results might have reflected that slightly in the other subjects I was taking, but...
Don't try that at home, kids.
Yeah, don't stay in school, don't be like me, and get your hair cut. Prior to going to music college, I saw another teacher in Plymouth called Dave Cox, who was really good, and he kind of got me started on things like advanced funk studies and that sort of thing, and the kind of independent stuff, which actually turned out to really, really pay off for me in terms of playing Bastille stuff and just general parts. Like if you're trying to learn complex sort of pop program parts, mm-hmm. Not your kind of like run of the mill kind of backbeat stuff, then having that little bit of kind of independence helps massively.
Yes.
And then post college, I studied with Bob Armstrong for about 3 years.
Brilliant.
I love Bob. Yeah, he's great. He often does assessments of like students when they first start, and he showed me mine. When I finished seeing him, I'm not done with him, but I'm never around to see him at the minute. But yeah. Basically, it said Chris Wood, jazz, no. that was his assessment of my jazz playing. So now Bob's great. So he kind of like took me through like kind of just getting a better sound out of the drum kit, like not clenching up on your sticks and letting the kind of sound of the stick go through the instrument, which I hadn't even considered. But when he showed me kind of a very dull old stick against quite a bright new stick, the kind of difference it makes in terms of your snare sound and your ride sound especially, it's drastic.
Yeah.
So all these kind of different approaches. Just kind of being a more kind of quality player. I'm flying my pint there. But so those are kind of my three main teachers. And for a period, I'd say at music college, studied under Mike Sturgis and Pete Riley as well, both top players as well.
Yeah.
Quite a broad education, but Bob kind of he really kind of got me thinking more professionally, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And all those interesting wrinkles that a lot of teachers don't pass on are really.
He had me doing my right hand only the jazz for about 3 months, literally. I was like, this guy's taking the piss.
But, have my money.
Yeah, but no. Then when you kind of see the overall picture, like you know what he's driving at. I was very, very glad of it.
Yes.
Sorry,
we're getting surrounded by flying insects here. We're getting dangerously close to swatting each other. But that's okay.
We'll get there one day.
Nothing
don't worry.
Personal. So, what do you reckon would be the most profound piece of advice you've ever received?
I could go on for ages about different bits. I guess something I've kind of found rather than been told is, as far as, I like a lot of people aim to kind of either they're in bands looking to get signed or they're aiming to be session players, going on tour, whatever. It's a great life, it's exciting, you get to go to places, but you spend 5% of your time playing, 95% of the rest of it, either waiting in airports, being in hotels, all that sort of stuff. So you need to be a good guy or girl. Hang out with. If you're carrying any sort of ego, you're going to get found out very quickly, and people aren't going to want to have you on tour.
Yes.
So, I've seen guys who get loads of work aren't necessarily the best or most flashy players, but they're reliable, professional, and generally good company. So that I would say, just don't carry an ego would probably be the kind of the big thing. But then at the same time, it's kind of knowing to play for the gig as well. I mean, I'm coming from a very kind of like I'm a rocker at heart. I'm essentially playing in a like a rock pop band. So coming from that sort of perspective, just not overplaying or like you're there to kind of help deliver the song. People want to hear the song and want to experience it. They don't care about maybe 2% of them might care about a drum solo. The rest of them don't want to hear you messing around. I've seen guys play for like kind of quite well-known pop stars. And it's kind of it's a done thing, the kind of gospel background where people just overplay a lot. And
yes.
But for me, it ruins the feel of the song. Where it's kind of something like kind of heavy or dubstepy. Yeah. You don't need to chuck in 30-second note fills in between every little vocal stab.
No, that's right. Unless of course you're Clem Burke and you find yourself in a perfect situation.
This is it.
In the band where you can get away with doing that, and or people love you for it.
This is it. Or even someone like Craig Blundell, like playing with Frost. That's kind of obviously like real proggy stuff. It's always demanded that you play crazy stuff. But yeah, horses for courses sort of thing.
Yeah.
I guess it's just kind of also thinking, especially if again going from the point of view of if you're in a band looking to get signed, you want everyone to be able to hear the song. So if you're smashing 10 bales of crap out of your kit, in a tiny pub, all they're going to hear is drums and not the song or the overall product. So you need to just be a little bit respectful of that as well.
That's sound, sage advice. People, take that on board.
Trust me.
So we talked about the roller coaster, the rock and roll roller coaster ride that you're at the moment. What's your most exciting career moment so far?
I'll give these kids a second to go.
Yeah.
Sorry. It kind of changes. Again, I feel so lucky to have kind of been doing what I've been doing so far, and that your goals change. Like mine initially, oh god, I stopped playing ping pong, aren't they? No, they're not.
Listeners, we inadvertently set ourselves up in the only on the only picnic table in the shade.
Yeah.
Inadvertently, right next to a ping pong table, which we hadn't realised.
But two young lads who did appear to be playing, then they gone away, so it's okay, I think. Sorry. So
we're clear.
Yeah, your goals kind of often change. Like my kind of thing was, I always dreamt of when I was playing in, like, I played in some awful venues, even played some awful like, awful rehearsal rooms. It's just, it looks like something like out of a horror film. There's these crazy stains on the wall. You're not quite sure what that came from. You don't want to know. But yeah, kind of like way back when, I was kind of like, my kind of favourite venue to kind of watch bands in is Brixton Academy.
Yes.
And that for me was always like an aspiration. If I could be in a band that one day could get to play Brixton, that would be ideal. That'd be great. But we're lucky enough to actually play two nights there in a row, sold out, and that's like a complete dream come true. But this was October last year. And yeah, so ever since then, just like things have gone crazy. Like we play the Brit Awards, we played the O2, we won a Brit Award. That's probably the single most terrifying thing I've ever done. I was the first one to speak out of all of us when we actually won and got the award. We had found out about 2 days prior to the awards that we'd won, and I was apparently instantly nominated to speak on behalf of everyone. So whilst everyone's there enjoying their drinks at the party, I'm just there like with head in my hands, like it's coming really soon. But thankfully, it went okay. I guess, somewhat selfishly, being from Plymouth, we got to play Plymouth Pavilions, which is like the kind of like big venue in my hometown. So that was massive for me. So like all the family there. Even had half of a Plymouth Argyle team there as well. My team, yeah. So managed to get everyone screaming Green Army at the end and that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's complete dream come true night. Yeah,
brilliant. Oh, we've got to get this one out of the way. This always comes up with a nice answer. Your own most embarrassing or hilarious
gig? It's embarrassing. I've had a couple gigs function. I've got a few wedding band stories because basically, yeah, my kind of mantra, and if you want kind of a bit of sage advice, do anything you can to avoid a real job. And in the process of doing said thing, I used to run a wedding band and play in different wedding bands as well. It's pretty good money when you're skint.
It beats working for a living.
This is it, yeah. So we've done a couple of ones where I felt for the guy so bad. The groom, the bride decided she wanted to sing the first dance, so this poor guy was made to stand in the middle of the dance floor by himself while she sang at him. It was Amazed by Lone Star, that great tune. Except she couldn't quite nail the key change, so then the singer from our band had to kind of sing the first part of the key change, then she joined in, so then that wasn't too bad. But my absolute hero of all weddings is the guy who requested Status Quo Rocking All Over the World for his song. Got there about 6 o'clock, he'd already had a few. Come half past nine when we started playing it, he was absolutely gone. Started playing the song, his boys pick him up, give him a king's chair around the room, and then it gets to the part of the song, and it goes, and I like it, and start passing the mic back and forth to the crowd to sing along, and there's this disturbance in the back of the room. You see this kind of presence coming through the crowd towards us, and it's him just pushing everyone out of the way. He just snatches the mic, screams, F off! Stumbles back over the monitor, knocks himself out on the drum kit, and that was half past nine. Ooh. That marriage was not consummated that night, I assure you.
No. Oh, I give that a matter of weeks.
My hero. So yeah, just basically lots of really painful wedding gigs, basically. But as far as Bastille ones go, we've done some shockers at some point, I know we have. it's more ones where, say, like, Will, the bass player, couldn't get there on time because he like missed his train or something, and then the boys are desperately trying to play bass parts on the key. It was ramshackle and horrible. Back in the early days, it's best to get your mistakes out of the way nice and early.
That doesn't happen now, does it? Band members arriving late through train delays.
Got a tour manager sort that out. That's fine. Yeah.
So, just changing tack a tiny bit. Back in your clinic earlier you were mentioning the fact that you're among our drummers who contribute vocals to the overall package as well as playing. Got any tips on that? A lot of people ask me about that.
Yeah, so well, this is kind of from my experience. I got lumbered with all the high parts.
the Roger Taylor.
This is the Roger Taylor. Also, Matt Helders from Arctic Monkeys. He sings all the falsetto stuff. So if that's happened to you, I would suggest, having seen we went and saw this West End vocal coach for a few weeks, really nice guy. He's like giving us this warm-up routine. Like, warming up's really important. You shouldn't just go in cold. You're going to wreck your voice, especially if you're touring and playing like consecutive nights.
Yes.
The biggest bit of advice he said as far as singing falsetto stuff is the natural instinct when you're singing high is to kind of tilt your head back, trying to sing high. That actually stretches your vocal cords more. You want to tilt your head downwards, and that makes it more relaxed, and you can sing higher for longer and more comfortably. So position your mic in such a way that I've basically got this kind of Frankenstein sort of mic stand that I've built out of like old boom stands and stuff, and a gooseneck and all that sort of thing. I've got a very low profile snare drum mic that kind of sits just in front of me. I managed to not hit it, which is good. If you've got a big long mic, it's going to be annoying. So you want to get your own specialist little mic for that. But it means then I can also see the rest of the kit because it's directly in front of me. Because the other thing everyone often does is to have a mic off to the side, like say over your left shoulder, if you're right-handed.
Yes.
That in itself is then kind of crushing up part of your neck muscles and your vocal cords, and again will cause you to strain yourself. So warm-ups for one, even if it's just doing like stupid siren sounds or whatever, just get yourself going. Or sing along to a couple of songs. And yeah, make sure your mic is just like right in front of your face and a little bit lower than you think you need it, would be my tip.
Great advice. Thank you, Chris.
Pleasure.
Thank you. So, the Global Drum Network is all about playing with passion. Mm-hmm. Whatever you play, play it with passion. Mm. So, what makes you most passionate about drumming, and who or what inspires you these days?
My kind of drumming hero, I suppose that would be a relevant place to start, is Dave Grohl. I think if you listen to like Dave Grohl's kind of drum parts, nothing is ever kind of done to excess. It's like every part in itself is almost a riff. So here, like playing with the Queens of Stone Age stuff, for instance, like no one knows really famous one. But yeah, all those fills in themselves. Like I defy anyone not to listen to a Dave Grohl track on when he's playing drums and not want to air drum along, even like whether you're a drummer or not. I think in terms of musicality,
absolutely,
sound he gets from it, it's just basically really intelligent playing. That's kind of thing I try to strive for. So. Rather than playing your kind of bog standard part, just kind of think how you can add a little bit more to it. He's kind of like a big influence on me. Obviously, there's the ones everyone's got, like Bonham, Mitch Mitchell, and whatever, Chad Smith, and people like that. I really like, but yeah, I think in terms of an intelligent, like hard hitting drummer, that's Dave Grohl, who's like head and shoulders above the rest for me.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thanks ever so much for your time. There was some great stuff in there.
Good, I hope so. Thank you.
And very, very best of luck with the onwards and upwards spiral.
Thank you, sir.
And the mad rock and roll roller coaster ride that you're on with Bastille.
Yeah. Well, long may it carry on, please.
Thank you, Woody.
Thank you, brother.
That's grand.
Good.
And to round things off for episode 8, here's a quick chat with two of the course's participants in 2014, Craig Zindani and Josh Stephen.
So the evening trundles on, boys and girls, in Global Drum Network land. We've stepped as far away from the bar as we can. The almost legendary Iron Pussy are halfway through their set. Stop sniggering at the back. And I've been joined by two of the participants from the Freddie G Drum Academy. We've got Craig over here and Josh over here.
Hello. Hiya. You all right?
I'm fine. So you're halfway through, just over halfway through your week. How's it been for you so far?
That's been fantastic. Really interesting. Quite full on.
Yes?
Yeah.
Are you being stretched?
I wouldn't say stretched. That kind of implies that there's something that you view as like way beyond what you're capable of doing or really, really far out of reach. A lot of it just mostly is cool ideas to work on at the moment, as opposed to something completely new that we've been given.
Okay.
But never been taught by any of the people here before, so it's a different spin on it from tutors I've had in the past. So yeah, it's been really good.
Excellent. And so your core tutors for the week, Craig Blundell and Steve White. Who else have you been working with?
We had Ralph Salmons today.
Yes.
Robin Guy was yesterday.
And we had Pete Cater.
Yes.
Tomorrow, Car Brazil should be flying in, actually, from what I've been told.
Oh,
yeah. It's nice they can fit us into his schedule.
Yes.
Also had Woody from Bastille coming today to do a masterclass.
Yes.
To be a guest tutor. But, yeah, that was a pretty cool show.
Uh-huh. Excellent. So, any standout highlights so far from your week?
I must say I was very impressed with Robin Guy. He was just, you know, on another level. It was just such amazing showmanship.
Yes, he is great.
Well, one thing I found interesting about the guest tutors in particular is from Monday and Tuesday when we had Pete and then Robin, they seem to be like completely polar opposite in terms of drumming. Not in technical ability, they're both really good drummers, but first of all we had Pete who was like proper jazz guy, really good technique, stressed how little effort he put into playing, he was all relaxed all the way throughout.
Yes.
And there was Robin who was like, oh, I sweat loads, and he just beat drums so hard. It was, just vastly different drummers.
Yeah.
It's good to see.
It is good to see. And really, you know, in terms of the people who are here this week, you've got 60 students right across the board, very young, not so very young, and all abilities, stylistically, all ends of the spectrum. It's great to see that many influences at work here, isn't it? Mm. You were talking about Ralph Salmons. What was he working on?
Well, he was talking to, I guess, some of the studio aspect, because that's what, you know, he's really known for, being one of the, you know, top session guys in London.
Mm.
And he was talking about sort of his approach and maybe the approach of actually what you would do in the studio, you know, kind of working to get the good sound.
Yep.
Rather than your own personal gratification.
Sure.
Because, you know, it's a fantastic insight, really, because, you know, if anyone knows, it's him.
Yes, for sure. He's been there and done it.
Yeah. It was interesting to see him get two drummers from each class as well up and kind of take their groove and just clean it up a lot.
Ah.
Through a metronome. We had two drummers in on like practice kits, and he would make them play to a click, and then he would just point out the little improvements that they needed to do to their playing.
Yes.
To make it just spot on and
great
in the pocket. Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Intense for them.
Yeah.
The spotlight on. Mm. That's good.
Definitely.
And tomorrow you've got Carl Brazil coming.
Yes.
And also, a real treat, a chance to actually play with two of the three members of Steve White's trio, Valori.
I know, that should be great, because I think some people weren't even... almost thought it was a joke when he said that, and found out it was true. I mean, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be slightly nervous when it comes round to it, but it's been pretty cool, the support-wise, this whole week, with people like not having to go at each other for screwing up on the kit or anything. And yeah, it's going to be fun.
So as we said, with so many people here from different musical backgrounds, different ages, different abilities, how are you finding that the organisers, the instructors are blending that?
It's quite interesting actually, because before I came on the course I wasn't quite sure how they're going to cater the course for, you know, such different levels, because, like, you know, there's people in the course that have been playing only a few months to people who've been playing, you know, aren't playing professionally now.
Right.
And they've, you know, managed to actually make the course actually suitable for everyone. I mean, they start off, you know, they might give you, say, an example that works great for a beginner, but they say, look, if you're an advanced player, you can do this. Or just some of the information in general, such as, you know, working as a session musician or how to get gigs, you know, is applicable to anyone, whether they've just started out in a band or whether they've been playing a band for their whole life.
Yeah, excellent. So with that in mind, how are you finding the instructors are managing to cope with such a diverse range of ages and abilities?
Well, it seems to be they're well organised, and they've got a lesson plan in mind that they know that can be, I guess, changed as and when for the appropriate class members.
Okay.
So, you know, say, for example, someone gets on the drum kit and plays one of the examples. They can't do it, you know, not a problem. Teacher says, well, try this instead. Whereas, say, if that person is an advanced player that can do it, he says, well, try this instead, and gives them something extra, an extra to add, and gives them other ideas that they can, you know, help improve their playing.
Excellent. So, would you recommend the course to anybody?
Definitely.
Yeah, I certainly would. Like I said, if you're a beginner, don't be afraid to come on the course, or if you're like, you know, a pro, don't feel like you're going to be wasting your time. And all the people you're going to meet on the course as well, and the teachers, is, you know, more than worth the time.
I'd say don't do it if you're planning on just knocking about and occasionally playing some drums, because you get worked. It's fun, but you do get worked quite hard by the tutors. They expect you to, you know, have a professional or just good classroom etiquette when you're studying. It's not like, you know, being in high school at a lesson you don't want to be at. They're professionals that they've put their time aside to come and do this, so don't really come unless you're fully prepared to do drums, a lot of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much for your time and your valuable insight. That was really good.
Cheers.
Enjoy the rest of your course.
Thank you very much.
That just about wraps things up for episode 8. Coming up in the next few episodes will be Big Country's Mark Brzezicki, Mel Gaynor from Simple Minds, and Nick Mason of Pink Floyd. Our interviews with Mark and Mel have already been recorded, but if you would like to submit a question for Nick, send them in quickly by email to info@globaldrumnetwork.com. My thanks this time to Craig Blundell, Chris Woody Wood, George Frederick of the Freddie G Drum Academy, Craig Zindani and Josh Stephen, and of course to you for listening. Thanks again, and always remember, whatever you play, play it with passion. Drum Network, beating out the rhythm of life worldwide.